Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, October 19th, and this is our weekly news roundup, and we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio in just a few minutes from the Cape Cod Times will be Cindy McCormick, and later in the program, we will be speaking with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, and Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. We'll start this morning speaking with Bill Evel at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Steve. How are you doing?
Bill, I am doing well, but I was up late watching that Red Sox game.
It continues. It keeps going on.
Bill, the school census came out recently, and you have a look at the changing population on the island school system. Tell us what's happening here.
Yeah, exactly. The school census came out this month, and of particular note was the long and steady rise in the English language learner population. In other words, students who have little or no English when they enter school. In 2012, 73 students fit this category. Today, 327 students fit this category, or 15% of the entire student body on the island. Now, on the Vineyard, this is predominantly the Brazilian students who speak Brazilian Portuguese as their first language. Now, as often happens with certain stories, it got me thinking, and I'm taking a little detour here because I went into the archives and I sort of thought, well, how did this all begin? And we were able to pinpoint it to one man back in 1985, Lyndon Johnson Piera, who came here from a town of Guayabera about an hour north of Rio. And the reason we know this is because a reporter at the Gazette, Daniela Gerson, actually went to Brazil to find this guy and sort of, detail the beginnings of this incredible migration. So she found him. He told her his story about, coming here as a young man to America to make some money. He was outside of Boston. And then was working a restaurant, and someone said, hey, there's a restaurant in the Vineyard looking for someone to work there. And so he came here. He said, according to the story, he was the only Brazilian here back in 1985. Really dug it, wrote home. And then about a year and a half later, he did have to go home because his father was ill, but he told people about it. Next year, 20 people came, and it just kept going. So it really is kind of fascinating. You can go back to this one small town. Fast forward to today, the Brazilian community is a huge and important part of the island community, as the census is pointing out, too. Now, back to the schools, they've really had to adapt to the increasing number. Currently, they have about two or three ELL teachers in each school. They say a student, typically, if they come into the schools in kindergarten with little to no English, they'll be proficient by fourth grade. They also said, of course, it's complicated. There's scheduling and hiring, and there's also different levels of proficiency and different ages. But the schools have been up for the challenge and have embraced it, and right, as of now, it seems to be working.
I was interested that the schools have to not only think about how they're teaching these students, they have to communicate with the families of these students.
Exactly, because sometimes the families don't have English either, so they've actually hired interpreters, particularly for, different school meetings. When parents are going to come, they want to make sure that everybody, knows what's going on. Much of their communications by email are sent out in both English and Brazilian Portuguese so that they can not just address the students, but also the parents, of course.
And the challenge, one of the big challenges for schools must be having enough English language learner teachers to meet the growing demand.
Yeah, a lot of them now, many of the schools have about two of the teachers, and now they're bumping up to about three. So, yeah, so they are out looking for teachers. But as of now, it seems that they're being able to meet the demand. But, yes, as they say, it's a constant challenge, and they, something they have to keep focusing on, especially as you look at the numbers, and it's really a steady rise, and that's not going to change, it seems, based on the numbers.
And for many of these young students coming in without strong English, it's not really just about learning the language. There are cultural issues around this that the teachers have to help them with.
Yes, of course. And, a lot of the teachers say, it's not just, as you said, not just about teaching the language, but talking about, many different subjects and coming at the language from different aspects so they're, assimilate to the world here. But also, it's really important to embrace their own heritage. So there's a lot of programming that talks about Brazilian heritage, too, which is great for not just Brazilian students, but the students here on the island to learn about the country of origin of their classmates.
Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette. Bill, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve. Take care.
I'm Steve Junker. With me in the studio this morning from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
And Cindy, let's start with you this week in Falmouth, where the saga of the two town-owned wind turbines continues. Neither of them are operating now, but the town has new hope that one of them may yet turn a profit.
Yeah, and some of the residents who abut that of the wastewater treatment plant property aren't too happy about this idea. That would be to move one of the wind turbines, a 400-foot turbine, to another spot on the property. It would cost about $3 million to dismantle, move, and set it up on its new site, and that's according to an engineering firm hired by the town. But they say that eventually the town could cover the cash outlay and produce a tidy net profit of $5.7 million over 20 years at its new location.
So $5.7 million over 20 years. The town select people must have been happy to hear this. What was the response?
They thought that this sounded like an appealing type of plan. But abutters did not think it was so appealing. They're still concerned. I mean, there have been 9 lawsuits filed against these turbines, Wind 1 and Wind 2, when the abutters have complained about ill health effects, flicker from the light and the shadow, noise. They say it's really impacted their health. And so these have been court ordered to stop functioning. And they're concerned that even at its new location, which would be, let's see, about half a mile northeast of its current location, that would still be an issue.
The study cost about $14,000, so I know the town is in quite a bit on these turbines. The idea of moving it to a new location, you can understand what the appeal is if they can make it work.
Right. Now, the engineer hired by the town says he doesn't believe any residential properties will be impacted by that flicker from that light and shadow. He also expected there would be reduced noise. And now residents with questions should submit them to the Board of Selectmen. There's also questions about Mark Cool. He was a former board member of the zoning board, and he questioned whether Wind 2 would even qualify for a special permit. Because Wind 1, which is an identical 400-foot turbine, was denied a special turbines after a special permit after a state appeals court ruled that it needed the special permit in order to operate.
And all of this is predicated on the idea that this turbine could run another 20 years.
Could run another 20 years without being interrupted by more lawsuits.
In Hyannis, they're seeing some big changes in the retail landscape. Let's start with the closing of a store that has really been an anchor for the Cape Cod Mall.
Yeah, Wendy Northcross from the Chamber of Commerce says Sears has been an anchor store since just about the very beginning of the mall, and it's going to be closing for good December 9th.
The Sears store, and there's some big bargains to be had, too, it sounds like, from the article that Cape Cod Times has.
Yes, clothing and select appliances at 40% off, outdoor furniture currently half off, and you can get a floor model mattress for 70% off.
Now, a new retailer is coming into that space.
Right, and I want to mention also the already closed. The Sears Auto Shop is closed this week. But yeah, it'll be divided into 2 spaces, and it's being called apparently at this point a red tenant and green tenant. Green is still a mystery, but red tenant will be Target.
It'll be the first Target on Cape Cod.
Right. It won't be one of their big stores. You know what I mean? They're not taking over the whole space. It'll be one of their smaller Target stores. But yeah, we'll have a Target here on Cape Cod.
Now, Sears also owns Kmart, which allows us to swing our attention to another Hyannis shopping plaza. The town is looking at proposals for redevelopment at what most people think of as Kmart Plaza. Some big proposal ideas here.
Oh, yeah, there's quite a few. This is a 26-acre property, and, you know, you drive by, and it looks just looks sort of like an old-fashioned strip mall, but there are plans afoot to really change that. And there's two commercial real estate development firms, including the parcel's current leaseholder, have submitted plans to redevelop the site. Now, this area, the site, is actually owned by the town, but is under the custody and control of the Barnes Municipal Airport. The winning bidder will be awarded a 49-year lease for the property, and so some of the plans include a developer called WS said that wants to have 75 units of housing, and if that's not possible, they would donate $2.5 million to the Housing Assistance Corporation over 11 years. There are plans for walking paths around a pond and a green for a child play area that could possibly morph into an outdoor skating rink in the winter. Now, there's a proposal by the Wilder Companies with O'Connor Capital Partners that would have almost 65,000 square feet of retail space. And so, that they would take down Cardi's Furniture, Famous Footwear, IHOP, and the former Sports Authority store and put up 4 new buildings.
Both these proposals the town is looking at, and it's going to have to make a decision. at some point on which one they want to go forward with.
Right. And the bidder will likely be selected by the end of the year. And that's according to airport manager Katie Service. And there's some of WS projects have been Derby Street Shops in Hingham, and Wilder properties include the Falmouth Mall and Southwind Plaza in Hyannis. And all these, both the proposals say they're looking at housing. They're looking at the possibility of housing there, multi-use. They're looking at these outdoor areas that will beautify the space so that when you go by, it won't look like that strip mall anymore. Just, you know, a huge parking lot in front with the line of stores.
No longer just the big box store approach here. They're talking about residential living on the upper floors and office space, as well as all those stores.
And then having standalone restaurants, possibly fronting a park-like area, and that would be with outdoor dining in the summer. So it sounds good. Both proposals sound good.
So again, leading bidder to be selected by the end of December, it looks like.
Right.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And on the phone with us right now from the Cape Cod Chronicle is Tim Wood. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, teacher contracts have stalled at Monomoy Regional School District. These are discussions over teacher contracts at the high school. One consequence has been the loss of a popular program. Tell us about this.
Indeed. The most recent contract between the Monomoy Regional School District, which covers Chatham and Harwich, and its main teachers union expired on June 30th. So teachers went into this academic year working without a labor agreement. Negotiations have been ongoing, but one of the casualties of the failure to reach an agreement thus far is Monomoy High's JOSM Hour. Now, this is a program that was launched just about a year ago, and it's a one-hour block, which includes the lunch period, that allows students to do a number of things, including seeking extra help from teachers and working on clubs and other projects. Since the time involved in the JOSM Hour is subject to labor negotiations because it involves teachers providing assistance to students. The initial trial phase of the program was run under agreement was reached to run a trial program for a year until a new contract was negotiated. Last week, Union President Sherry Ann Armstrong said that trial phase at this point is over until it can be the JOSM Hour details can be worked into a new agreement. So the JOSM program officially ended on Monday. Now she praised the program, which she said was strongly supported by faculty, administrators, and students. It allowed students, for instance, who can't come to school early or stay late because of jobs or family obligations, to get that extra help. Mm-hmm. And it also gives students the ability to make their own decisions about their time and help foster autonomy and personal growth. Armstrong said at last week's school committee meeting that teachers should not be blamed for the program ending, that it's caught up in a very complex negotiation situation, which neither she nor school committee chairman Donna Richardson would really go into detail about. They really wouldn't tell us what the sticking points are in the contract at this junction. As usual, negotiations are subject to executive sessions at which the public and press are not allowed. Although we've been able to ascertain that basically they're talking about compensation issues, which, as you know, is usually the sticking point when it comes to contracts, labor contracts. There was a strong show of support for teachers at the school committee meeting, with dozens of them holding signs, students speaking in favor of the teachers, and also talking in support of this JOSM Hour program. Now, the next step in this process, they actually held a mediation session this past week, we haven't heard from either party as to how progress went in that session. But they say that they're trying to reach a settlement as soon as possible, so they can restore the Jocelyn Hour program, which everybody seemed to agree was a good thing for the school.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for that.
Thank you, Steve.
With me in the studio is Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, Election Day is coming up November 6th, but early voting begins next week. Your reporter Jeff Spillane has a nice look at how the process works. It's still kind of a new process for town officials.
Yeah, this was the early voting was the state is offering it once again for the midterm elections, and town clerks in the Cape are bracing for a heavy turnout. So this was the debut was in 2016. That was a presidential election, and the early voting was very popular. Town clerks say it also was an administrative nightmare because this is the first time they've handled it, and they said that they've worked out a lot of the kinks this time around. They've identified the issues and worked it out. Nearly 50,000 people. That's 30%. Of Cape Cod's registered voters cast ballot before Election Day in 2016.
I thought that was a high number. I was surprised to see that.
Yeah, and they said that they're expecting, you know, to be just as popular, if not even more now, because these midterm elections are, you know, attracting a lot of attention. And they think that the people who enjoyed the early voting the last time around will want to do it again, and that other people will want to try it because they've heard good things about it. And the early voting this year takes place from October 22nd to November 2nd, but the deadline to register was Wednesday, this Wednesday.
Now, having gone through this process once in 2016, town administrators have an idea of what to expect a little bit and how to tweak the process to make it easier for themselves.
Yeah, and Dennis, the town clerk, Teresa Bunce, she's one of the people who thinks it's going to be higher, you know, a higher early voting turnout. And she and officials there have set up several voting booths in a town hall conference room to give it the appearance of a typical precinct polling place.
And why is it such an administrative burden for these town officials?
Well, the first time around, it was just, you know, working out the different kinks and the different way, you know, and keeping track of everything and just and the counting. It was just the initial experience. But this time they feel they've got things under control. They know how it works. They know what to expect. Or they don't know quite what to expect because they don't know how high the turnout is going to be.
And these ballots, these early voting ballots, actually have to be kept in a vault until Election Day to be counted.
Right. They have to. Yeah, there's probably, it sounds like a little bit more security issues around it just because you have, you know, things coming in at different times and same places. But and the other thing is that they have many local town halls are offering extended weekday hours, so you can come. So normally they close, you know, at a certain time, but they're offering extended weekday hours so that people can vote after work. And some are going to be open on Saturday, October 27th.
And I guess one thing town administrators are pointing to is that this requires a fair amount of additional work, and there's no additional funding for most of these towns to cope with it.
Right, because you've got the additional hours, and obviously someone has to be staffing those additional hours.
It ends up as a kind of an unfunded mandate, one of them is pointing out. Following up on a story we spoke about last week, local legislators weighed in on the Steamship Authority's proposed design for a new ferry terminal. They didn't sound very happy about what was being suggested.
No, State Senator Vinny DiMacedo, who's Republican from Plymouth, and State Representative Dylan Fernandez, Democrat from here in Woods Hole, have asked the Steamship Authority to go back to the drawing board for the design of the new ferry terminal in Woods Hole.
And what are they concerned about here?
Well, they're concerned because residents seem to be pretty unhappy with the design that was unveiled. It was a glass and stone building. A resident said it looked too much like a ski lodge in Aspen. And actually, both legislators seem to be of the same view. And they wrote an open letter to Robert Davis. He's the general manager of the Woods Hole, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket Steamship Authority. They said the building will define Woods Hole for millions of visitors for decades to come. It should look like Woods Hole.
It's a big building that's being proposed. I can tell you that from looking at the article, it says that it's going to be about 45 feet high.
Yeah, it's actually 35 feet high, but the buildup of land under it to keep it out of the flood zone will elevate it to 45 feet. And that's an issue because residents also say it's going to obliterate this quintessential Woods Hole view from the Crane Street Bridge. That kind of like landmark view is going to be the classic view will be gone. So that's another issue with it.
And Representative Fernandez suggesting that perhaps the design should resemble something more like what the other island terminals look like on Nantucket and the Vineyard.
Yeah, he said that he was impressed with their terminals and that they successfully incorporated the New England flavor of the town where they are located. Now, the architects, BIA Studio, said last week that they thought that the salt box design reflected New England design. Mm-hmm. And they also said, you know, the rock and the stone and the glass would hold up to the elements. But local residents are like, nah, looks like Aspen.
Aspen. Big construction project overall. They're looking at a 6-year rebuild of this terminal. It's going to be
$60 million, 3 new ferry slips, and 2 new passenger loading piers. So a very important project for the Cape and Woods Hole.
We're going to speak right now with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve.
Ed, Provincetown has a special town meeting coming up. Tell us about what's on the agenda here.
Well, yes, October 29th is the upcoming special town meeting in Provincetown, and it seems appropriate for Halloween week because looking at the warrant, it seems pretty scary. It's a long warrant for a special town meeting, 26 articles, and there's a variety of issues dealt with, including two land acquisitions, the Elena Hall property on Commercial Street and the Dwyer property on Bradford Street. These are parcels that the Open Space Committee in Provincetown has been seeking for a while. The Hall property involves a piece of beachfront that the conservationists in town would very much like to preserve as open space on the waterfront, and the Dwyer property is a woodland that is adjacent to an existing woodland path not far from the center of town. Those are both on the warrant with price tags of $1.4 million for the Hall property, $1 million for the Dwyer property. Then the other big financial issue is the wastewater expansion authorization. This has been in the works for a while. As you may know, there's been a moratorium on most kinds of development in Provincetown for a while now because of the limited capacity of the town sewer system. And since 2015, town boards have been approving additional amounts of sewage flow only for certain kinds of situations, public health issues, affordable housing, and municipal services, and one or two other situations. The expansion that is now being proposed on this special town meeting warrant would end that moratorium by providing an additional 155,000 gallons of Title V design flow. And this, according to Public Works Director Rich Waldo, would end the moratorium and allow for just more private hookups to the sewage system. And the cost of that is $6 million. But according to the warrant article, this would be paid for through betterments and grants. So theoretically, it wouldn't actually increase the taxes. It would just increase costs to people who are newly hooking up to or using the sewer system. Then, besides those issues, there's a number of charter amendments. At least four on the warrant that relate to the new charter that was actually adopted in 2017, went into effect in town in July of this year. But there are a number of provisions in the new charter that was adopted that people are unhappy with. And so the articles on this town meeting warrant, many of them simply eliminate the changes and go back to the provisions of the previous charter. For example, Article 13 on the warrant would amend the charter to reinstate term limits for all elected and appointed town boards. Article 14 would restore and clarify the contracting authority of the Board of Selectmen, which in the new charter is given to the town manager. So this change would take it away from the town manager, give it back to the Board of Selectmen. There are some other amendments as well having to do with the powers and duties of the selectmen and the town manager. And in Article 20, there's an interesting case also involving a change to the charter where this article would remove a charter change that allows part-time residents to be appointed as alternates to non-regulatory town boards. So if this article passes, then part-time residents would not be allowed to serve as alternates on boards. And this relates to a long-standing controversy in Provincetown over, you know, what is the relationship between full-time and part-time residents? Many, many towns in the Commonwealth do allow part-time residents to serve on non-regulatory boards. We actually have a letter to the editor in this week's paper about this issue from a writer who says it seems petty to restrict participation in civic affairs in this way. So I think it's going to be a very interesting town meeting. It's on, you know, scheduled for Monday night of Halloween week, and I wouldn't be surprised if it lasts more than one night.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thanks for bringing us up to date on that.
You're welcome, Steve.
Cindy McCormick with me from the Cape Cod Times in the studio here. Cindy, opponents to a potential casino are calling for a quick resolution to the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe's appeal of a land ruling. It's the latest turn in a story that we have been following for quite a while.
Yes, the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe has requested a stay in this ongoing appeal of this 2016 judgment of the U.S. District Court in Boston, when the Interior Secretary said that the tribe did not that the Interior Department did not have the authority to take the lands into trust for the tribe. Now, what's happening now is the plaintiffs who are suing the Interior Department over the decision are requesting that the tribe withdraw its appeal of the case or be required to file opening briefs within 60 days. The attorney for the plaintiffs said that there's a fear that this appeal could go dormant for years if the stay is granted, that this will just drag on and on and on.
The tribe is trying to protect its land in trust, both for this casino proposal and in a bigger way, and has filed a suit sort of pushing back against the decision of the Department of the Interior here. So it's two lawsuits here that are kind of dovetailed together.
Right, exactly, because there have been different interior decisions. And then the most recent one was on September, and that's when this is the subject of a new lawsuit by the tribe, because there was a that action, and that was September 27th, that was from the Interior Department reversed an Obama-era decision to secure those 320 acres of tribal land into trust because it wasn't under federal jurisdiction in 1934. So the issue was, okay, this was part of the Indian Reorganization Act that affected more directed toward Western tribes. Mm-hmm. And did Massachusetts have a similar really relationship that could be considered a substitute for this federal recognition? And the decision was like, no, it didn't pass muster. And now the tribe is suing about that because this has been going on for quite a while, and the tribe did intend to build this a large casino in Taunton, and have the lands, you know, in trust in Mashpee and Taunton.
And the opponents of that casino are the ones who are asking for the appeal to be lifted or for this to move forward, because they have a fear that if it's waiting on this other lawsuit, it could be forever to settle the appeal.
Right, because that's what they're saying, like go dormant for years. And so that's why they would say either, you know, they want the tribe to either withdraw its appeal of the case or be required to file opening briefs within 60 days. So it's like to get things moving again. This has been a very, very long process. But
and the tribe, I think, is saying that the opponents are being funded in part, perhaps, by other interests in that casino fight.
Right, yes, that there are other casino developers interested in getting involved in a different casino in Massachusetts, and that would be competition, and they would just love to see the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe knocked out of the competition.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Gazette. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Cindy, we were just speaking about the Mashpee Wampanoag's bid for a casino and what it means for their land in trust. Meanwhile, the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe is suing the Mashpee Conservation Commission, and this has to do with oyster aquaculture around an area that may be facing development.
Yeah, this is this concerns Gooseberry Island, and they in order for you to develop anything, you have to submit a listing, a delineation of wetlands around your property. And the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe is saying that this listing or delineation submitted by the owners of Gooseberry Island to the Conservation Commission did not was inaccurate, and it neglected to include a coastal dune and coastal beach and tidal flats. And this is all very close to the tribe shellfish hatchery, and they said this is of concern to them because they're afraid they'll be developed and that will impact their shellfish resources.
Gooseberry Island has a little bit of history here of the owners wanting to develop it.
Yeah, they wanted a bridge built, and that was turned down. And then they actually wanted a house built, and that was also turned down. And that was turned down initially because the town officials were like, "Well, there's no access. If there's a fire, how would firefighters get out there?" And so they came back with this proposal for a bridge, but that was also turned down.
The tribe is concerned that if some development happens there, all their oyster aquaculture, as you say, their hatchery, their nursery is right up against that.
Yes, and then George Chucky Green is the tribe's director of natural resources, and he says it's not just the tribe. He says the whole town is going to suffer if a house goes up on that island. He says that a septic system there would not serve the purpose that oysters serve now, because oysters, you know, cleanse the water, and this has been the tribe has been working with the town to improve the water quality of the estuaries and water areas in the town of Mashpee.
And the oysters themselves improving the water quality.
Right, there. Exactly.
The Town Conservation Commission, what do they have to say about the lawsuit?
Well, they say that this, you know, the fact that this these the coastal dunes and the coastal beach or the tidal flats weren't specifically spelled out, you know, doesn't mean that they're not going to be reviewed in any project that comes up. It doesn't mean that they're not going to consider that.
They're saying it wasn't really a mistake, and they will be considering the entire ecosystem.
Right,
there.
And this is a 3.5 acre island in Papanesid Bay.
We're going to speak right now with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Brian.
Hey, Steve. How's it going?
It's going well. Brian, you've got a story about a new program for school athletics. It's called the Unified Sports League. Explain this for us.
Sure. The Unified Sports League is a new league that the Martha's Vineyard Regional High School is now a part of. It's a partnership kind of with the Special Olympics of Massachusetts, and it has kids with intellectual disabilities play sports with kids that don't. So right now they're doing basketball, and in the spring they're going to be doing track and field. We got to go to one of their games. It was their second game and their first home game, and it was really great to see a lot of the students' parents came out, a lot of their friends, a lot of people from the school. The principal, the superintendent, they all came out, and it's led by special education teacher and physical education teacher, Ryan Kent. And he said that the games are always an absolute blast. Everyone has a lot of fun, and all the students are all really excited to play. Everyone gets a chance to grab the basketball, take a shot, and one of the players, Winnie Wells, her parents were there, and they were so excited because they said that about 2 weeks ago she was doing kind of underhanded throws with the basketball, mm-hmm. and already her shot, she's got a really great jump shot. She scored 8 points. They finished the game 38-32. They lost to Falmouth, but everyone had a great time, and their next game is going to be at home next week against Plymouth.
Brian, looking at another story, you had a chance to speak with part-time island resident and former Secretary of State, among his many titles, John Kerry. What are some of the highlights from that conversation?
Sure, yeah. I got a chance to speak with former Secretary Kennedy, and he told me about his new biography, Every Day is Extra, and the title is kind of a philosophy on life that he got when he was serving in Vietnam, about how each day that you have is an extra day, and, you know, what do you do with that day? And he's done quite a lot. And he talked about everything from his childhood to his time in Vietnam, his time as a congressman, and during the presidential election.
Hmm. You also asked him a little bit about his island life. It sounds like he suffered from a condition many of us have during the summer. He was working so much this past summer, he didn't get as much time to spend as he would have liked doing things like sailing and being sort of enjoying his time on the island.
Yeah, he was so focused on writing his biography that he said he regretted he didn't get to go out as much to some of his favorite vineyard places, like the Red Cat, Cardboard Box, and especially Backdoor Donuts. He's a huge Backdoor Donuts fan.
Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
With me in the studio is Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, an advisory group met last week to take on issues around right whale protection. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this meeting ended last week, a week ago on Friday, with some suggestions that, such as more temporary area closures and possible testing of new technologies that will change fishing gear so it causes less harm to the North Atlantic right whales. And this is according to National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration fisheries biologist Colleen Coogan. Now, Arthur Sawyer from the Massachusetts Lobstermen Association said that there was extremes on both ends, but they're trying to work toward the fishermen and lobstermen are trying to work with the scientists toward a solution that will benefit, that both sides can agree with. And they'll be meeting again in March about this.
And what are some of the ideas they have for how to protect large whales, right whales?
Well, one of the things is, you know, to change the fishing gear so it releases. There's, you know, they have right now, they say there are about a million vertical fishing lines connecting traps to surface buoys in areas of the U.S. and Canada where right whales migrate, calve, and forage for food. And so this is, they get entangled in this gear. So they're talking about, you know, sometimes buoys that the fishing traps that aren't actually connected by vertical lines that you would find using technology.
So ropeless buoy systems
systems. Mm-hmm. And also just having temporary closures in some areas where there are ship strikes, for instance, where there seem to be a number of ship strikes, because this is the right whale population is really in decline. It took an unusual hit last year with the documented death of 17 animals in Canadian U.S. waters. So far, there's been two deaths this year. One of the huge issues is, though, what's happening to the females in this population. There's a greater number of years between when the females give birth, and there's an overall lack of calves. There were zero last year. And the concern is that, the population was 451 in 2016, and that's compared to, let's say, 2010. The peak was 481, and it's been declining since then. And scientists say that all the recovery that was achieved leading up to 2010, those 3 years of recovery will be lost by 2029 if the current rate of decline continues. And there are other issues that are less in the control of fishermen, but they say that there's an unusually fast warming of the Gulf of Maine. That was a September memo that came out. And so what's happening is that lobsters are getting these from this unexpected or unanticipated warmth, lobsters are developing shell disease, and lobstermen are going farther north. Mm-hmm. And that is putting them in contact with these whales.
More in the path of the whales.
More in the path of the whales.
And the whales are looking for food, and it sounds like their food source is also shifting with warming waters.
Yeah, their food sources are shifting, and they're going into, like, the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And the females, you know, all the whales are following the food source, of course. But the problem is the females calve off of Florida and Georgia, and this this extra mileage actually takes a toll on them. Mm. You know, it uses more energy, so they're just not in as good shape as they would have been otherwise, and that makes them even a healthy whale could be destroyed by a boat strike or becoming hopelessly entangled in fishing lines. But some do survive, but it's better if you're healthier and a stronger whale and you're able to recover.
And we are talking specifically about right whales. And one other thing I want to mention that they talked about here was about ropes that can break at a lesser strength. They're talking about weaker ropes, fishing with weaker ropes.
Fishing with weaker ropes, and in some cases maybe not even using ropes at all. I think that was tested in Australia, where they located these with sonar with their lobster traps. And so there's a lot of things under discussion, but fishermen and lobstermen want to maintain their livelihood, mm-hmm. at the same time that there's a huge interest in making sure that the North Atlantic whale population doesn't actually go extinct.
Let's talk a little bit about aquaculture. The Cape has a growing aquaculture industry. There are worries, however, about the potential impacts to shellfish from ocean acidification. Your reporter Doug Frazier has an article looking at this.
Yeah, well, there's this new commission called in the Bay State. It's called the Ocean Acidification Commission, and that's to deal with what is known as the evil twin of global warming. Mm-hmm. That's ocean acidification, and that's because oceans absorb carbon dioxide, and in fact, 1/4 of carbon dioxide is absorbed by the ocean. But that results in an acid buildup that can inhibit shell building, especially in larvae. And this has been a disaster for shell fishermen in other parts of the country. A sudden onslaught a decade ago in the Pacific Northwest caused 70 to 80% die off of oyster larvae in Washington State.
And so that's in the Pacific Northwest. We haven't seen that here yet.
We have not seen that here yet, but this is shell fishermen fear this, and that's why they are that's why they back this new Ocean Acidification Commission, and they're hoping that between the scientists getting together and the shell fishermen getting together, that they can prevent some sort of sudden event like this. For instance, when that happened in Washington State, which has over 3,000 jobs in the shellfish area, half the state's production. Half of the state's production and hundreds of employees had to be relocated to Hawaii. And this is just so when it happens, it seems to happen suddenly. And right now they say it's the time to take steps to avoid this.
And at the same time, it looks like ocean acidification has been underway for quite some time.
Right. And it also affects sea scallops and lobsters. And it's one of those things that happens out of sight. That's according to Lawrence Maiden, who's the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution Vice President of Research. He says it's not as obvious as sea rise. It's more sneaky and difficult to reverse. And he said, yeah, that the ocean water is 30% more acidic over the last two centuries. Well, this Smithsonian reports that the Smithsonian is reporting that. And the Smithsonian says that this has been a faster change in ocean chemistry than any in the last 30 million years. So we're talking.
One more effect of climate change happening right around us here.
Right.
Cindy, a number of major projects are underway in Yarmouth, and that town is giving careful attention to coordinating these projects so they don't step on each other. Tell us about this.
Yeah, well, there are several bridge replacements and a handful of intersection improvements, but there's also going to be a piping associated with a new sewer system. So the DPW director, Jeffrey Colby, he updated the selectmen on Tuesday, saying that the plan is you don't want to be digging up these freshly paved roads with these new projects for the sewer pipes. You want to coordinate this so that it all works together and you don't have to spend extra money or extra time or to inconvenience travelers as much. So one thing that town is paying to replace the Route 28 bridge over Parker's River, and that's expected to take place after Labor Day. It's going to cost $4 million. The town is looking for grants to help defray that cost. And there is they're also going to widen the span. That said, that will be helping with flushing of the water underneath. So not only will you get a nice new bridge, that the surrounding wetland should be improved. And then there's another bridge that's going to be that's slated for replacement by the State Department of Transportation, and that's the Route 28 bridge over Bass River.
And there's some land takings associated with a little bit of this, it looks like, and it's all still coming into place.
Right. There are several pieces of land taken by the different easements have been required, and some have been taken by eminent domain. And the Captain Parker's, in the case of the Parker's River Bridge, Captain Parker's Restaurant, and the group that owns the Whydah Pirate Museum have agreed to grant easements.
Hmm. Let me ask you about a story in Bourne. The contention over recreational marijuana sales there is continuing.
Yeah, well, this ban was passed at the October 1st special town meeting, and that was 415-321 vote. But Gray Gables, a born resident, Aaron Toby Jr., says that that does not represent the will of the townspeople. He thought that a lot of young people just didn't turn out because they thought that this was going to pass. And they are looking to have another. He has a group of people. He said they number at least 15, and they are looking to possibly call for another special town meeting to take another look at this, another vote on this.
That was interesting. They're actually conducting a poll right now to try to understand how people are feeling about recreational marijuana in Bourne.
Yeah, because in order to get a special town meeting, they'd have to launch a petition drive. But before they do that, they're doing an online survey to sort of gauge interest and asking what people think of this. And the special town meeting can be called if 200 registered voters sign this petition. And that's according to the Secretary of State. So the survey posted on Saturday asked if you support the ban, on recreational marijuana stores, and if you want to reverse the ban, and if you're in favor of these establishments, you know, how many do you think a town like Bourne could support?
Mm. And looking at that particular coalition looking to get younger people out and involved in this question.
Yeah, they say that they just stayed home then because they sort of thought this was like a done deal, and that the opposition, though, to these recreational marijuana stores was much more organized and they turned out to vote. So they're looking to see if there's interest. If there's interest, we'll go for the petition. Mm-hmm. And if the petition succeeds, then there'll be another special town meeting on this and get out the vote, including the younger voters. And the other thing is that some town officials were in favor of having some kind of bylaws allowing three recreational or medical marijuana facilities, because they say that after this moratorium ends November 30th, town's not going to have a heck of a lot of control over it. Mm-hmm. Only state and local board of regulations and rules will apply.
Cindy, you reported a story this week. It was about a conference in Hyannis of school and municipal facilities administrators from around the state. It sounds like the big topic there was school safety in possible shooter situations.
Well, you know, they did this is not your usual suspects with active shooter situation, discussing the active shooter situations. This was not this was an association of school facilities administrators and municipal facilities administrators. And they did address HVAC and those sorts of issues later in the conference. But the first day, which they were actually calling a pre-conference, was devoted to school safety and how to handle active shooter situations.
What kinds of things were they talking about?
Well, they were talking about the safety film on windows, for instance, if putting it in like in vestibules and cafeterias and places where people gather. And they actually went to Cape Gunworks for a demonstration to see how that would work. Also, what it looks like when bullets of different calibers hit drywall and doors. And some of them were shocked that some bullets went through the safety film. But overall, people were pleased to see that the glass didn't shatter. It made it shatterproof. So an active shooter could not come in and just shoot out the windows if you have this applied. But they also talked about the importance of evacuation plans. They said mm-hmm. that, you know, and one facilities administrator from Maynard said that in the school system in their town, they actually had a fire captain play the role of an intruder and go through the halls of a middle school or high school. And he was tracked via surveillance and video surveillance and also the PA system. And he said that the teachers – so the power was sort of given to teachers and students to make the decision, and he said they made the right decisions. Everybody who could evacuate safely evacuated, and people, the classrooms that couldn't, did their lockdown and stayed in place, and no one ran into the fire captain posing as the intruder.
Well, that's good. I want to thank my guest, Cindy McCormick. Cindy, thanks for being with us this week.
Oh, you're welcome.
This is our news roundup with us from the Cape Cod Times, Cindy McCormick. Also, we heard from Bill Evel at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We spoke with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner and Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.